think there's no better example than the sport, footwear, and apparel industry around function and form following function. You know, think about Bill Bowerman when he was creating the first footwear at Nike. It was about making it as lightweight as possible.
Hi everyone, thanks for tuning into Notes of Design. To help support our mission spread knowledge, we have a very special guest in today's episode. Let's welcome Karen Corrales-Reuter, a design luminary with over 20 years of experience. Karen is an experienced creative executive and a design critic in architecture at Harvard's Graduate School of Design. She was a senior fellow at Harvard's Advanced Leadership Initiative. Prior to Harvard Leadership Initiative, she was a Vice President, Creative Direction plus Future at Reebok and Global Creative Director at Nike for 12 years, where she developed major product merchandising and brand strategy, solidifying Nike at the top of its industry. Karen is practicing activist, committed to inclusion by design, ending gender bias in product design. In this episode, Karen shared her journey into design, empathizing curiosity, continuous learning, and resilience as key for beginners. Karen delved into her design process, revealing a behind-the-scenes look at creating new collections where balancing innovation with practicality is crucial. She highlighted the necessity of balancing form and function, especially when designing products that are both aesthetically pleasing and performance-oriented. Facing challenges head-on, Karen recounted overcoming obstacles through collaboration and a solution-focused approach, keeping the customers at the center. Later then, we spoke on discussing the impact of fast fashion, concerns over sustainability, and envisioned a future where emerging technologies and AI plays a pivotal role in creating personalized and sustainable fashion. We then concluded the show by Karen's book recommendations and her biggest inspiration in design space. Her insights in this episode provide a treasure trove of inspiration and guidance for anyone looking to navigate the ever-evolving landscape of design. Hi, everyone. Thanks for tuning into Nodes of Design. Today, we have a very special guest with us. Hi, Karen. Welcome to Nodes of Design. It's a pleasure hosting you today on our show.
Hi, Taj. Nice to see you.
So, Karen, how was your day so far?
You know, it's been a good day so far. You know, there was a pretty major decision yesterday on affirmative action here in the U.S. as it relates to our universities. And so I woke up feeling quite concerned and remain concerned, but also cautiously optimistic and really dedicated to diversity in our universities. As a designer, I know how critical diversity is to the creative process. And, you know, it sort of fires you up and makes you even more committed than you were before.
That's wonderful, Karen. So if you could give a brief about yourself to our listeners out there.
So I grew up in a corner of Northwest Indiana, known as the region, the south side of Chicago. And I pursued my degree in industrial design at Purdue University. And from there, I spent many years in the high tech industry designing computer hardware. And after that, had my own company in Germany together with my husband in Munich, where we worked for some of the most inspiring brands in industrial design, Braun, Miele, Hans Grohe, and really had an amazing learning experience again in Germany. And then I received a call from a sports brand out in Oregon, that was Nike, and decided to join Nike at the time that they were creating their tech labs and equipment division. And I spent 12 years there at Nike in various roles. Moved back to the East Coast, and most recently was Vice President of Creative Direction and Innovation at Reebok until I made the pivot and decided to pursue a fellowship at Harvard, where I could really take a look at the breadth of my experience and what I should be doing next.
Thank you so much, Karen. What was your journey into design?
Yeah, so I grew up in the corner of Northwest Indiana. It really is about the south side of Chicago. And I am the proud granddaughter of four Greek immigrants and attended Purdue University and, you know, discovered industrial design, which has been my career for many, many decades in a drawing class in my second year at Purdue. And I had always dreamed of designing cars, but didn't quite know where I should go to study. And so was in more of an architecture illustration program. And a professor of mine named Peter Miller, who asked me if I had heard of industrial design, Tej, and I said I had not. And he said, it's like an architect for product. And I remember exactly where I was standing when he said that and said, you can be that. And he said, yes. And so I've never looked back from that career in industrial design. And actually, finally met with Professor Miller again after that moment to thank him. Just this past week, someone was able to locate him for me many, many, many years later. So I have been a designer by training and practice for my entire career and started in the computer industry in Boston, designing hardware for two companies that were quite notable here in New England, Wang Laboratories and Digital Equipment, and really love the idea of really bringing human-centric design and being concerned with things like aesthetics, when at the time, it was a very engineering-driven industry. From there, I moved to Germany, to Munich, Germany. My husband is also a mechanical engineer, as you mentioned that you are. We had our own company for about 7 years. And, you know, being in Germany as an American designer was so eye-opening, not just the cars, but the entire design philosophy and ethos of design there. And then I received a call about a position at Nike to join their equipment division when they were starting out. And I know many of those, my colleagues there who I still have the utmost respect, ended up at Microsoft, some ended up at Dell, but worked in the equipment division and then spent 12 years out at Nike in Oregon. Again, made the move to Boston, but really stayed focused on the sport, footwear, and apparel industry for the last two decades.
Thank you so much, Karen. So how do you stay on top of industry emerging trends and design styles?
You know, I think as someone who spent most of their career on the corporate side and with well-known brands, I think first and foremost, you have to understand what your brand stands for. To understand what role it plays in the consumer's lives. And then really being laser focused on what the consumer, your consumer, what your customer cares about. I believe there was a time where we followed trends or identified trends and really wanted to respond to trends. But I think that with the vast world that we live in now, with the interconnectivity, it's more important to even stay more focused and stay even, I would say more focused on your consumer and your brand. I think as designers, it's our role to really understand sort of the rigor and the data of what it's showing us about where our consumer is going, what the possibilities are, but also to know when we should react on our gut. And I think it's that combination that really keeps us, you know, identifying the to use your terminology, the industry's emerging trends, to identify what is relevant and what's meaningful for the area, the expertise, the brand you're working for. I also, you know, somebody once told me many years ago to just keep an eye out for repetition and pattern. And as a designer, you know, I think that's our superpower is to connect the dots. So when you start to see an emerging pattern or an emerging trend, that's sort of the time to, you know, press the pause button and look deeper. So I would say, trust your gut, do the research, and those emerging trends that are most meaningful to what you're working on will reveal themselves.
That's wonderful, Karen. So what is the design process like when creating a new footwear or apparel collection? Could you share with us some behind the scenes?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, as and I'll respond primarily as a creative director, right? So when you're when you're responsible for creative direction for an entire brand, and you're starting off the season, right? That metabolism of a season is relentless, right? Especially in the footwear and apparel industry. You need to start to connect. So I'll go back to the whole idea of what does your brand stand for and what does your consumer care about? And what your brand stands for doesn't always change. It shouldn't change season after season, right? It should have the response to emerging trends. It should be able to respond to what's happening in the world. But you should have those things that you stand for. I think it's what the consumer cares about that really starts to lean into starting that creative process and that product process. One of the things that I like to lean into a lot, we call it the rhythm of life. Some refer to it as the moments that matter. You know, really looking at the time you want to release product, what is going on, what will be going on in your consumer's life, and then meet them where they are. That has always served me to set up the start of any design process. Of course, then you combine that with the latest innovation and the technologies available to you, right? And that uniqueness of approach and the magic that each brand brings. But it's that partnership of knowing what's happening when, the moments that matter, and then the technology, the innovation, what you have available to you to start that product creation process.
Thank you so much, Karen. So how do we make sure we make a brand message that is inclusive and it includes almost everyone? And when we design for scale, how could we make sure the inclusion is at the center?
That's a great question. And I've actually been thinking a lot about that in my current role and really focused on inclusion by design. The design brief, Tej, is so important. And I think in many cases, as designers, we feel that we are given the design brief, right? We are given the design brief and that this isn't a dialogue. And I would say the best and the most consistent pathway to being inclusive and to make sure we're designing for the right environment, the right audience, is for the designer not only to understand and be able to absorb the brief, but also to be able to challenge the brief. And so that opportunity to challenge a brief before the design even starts is very, very powerful. In my experience, it's oftentimes looking at that brief and saying, who isn't included in that brief? Who are we missing in this brief? Who are we limiting from interaction? I think it's in those moments when we can tighten a design brief is when we become the most inclusive. And when we become the most inclusive, we're actually opening the aperture to a much wider audience.
Thank you, Karen. So how do you balance form and function when designing products for performance and fashion?
So I'm a form follows function designer. That's one of the reasons why I became an industrial designer, is that it really is the most important for me to design into form, to design form into the way something works. And I think that's what ultimately makes it beautiful. And that's what makes it a beautiful form. One of the most inspiring and amazing opportunities of designing in the sport, footwear, and apparel industry is designing for athletes and really understanding what it means to them, right? And understanding that performance really does drive the aesthetic. I think there's no better example than the sport, footwear, and apparel industry around function and form following function. You know, think about Bill Bowerman when he was creating the first footwear at Nike. It was about making it as lightweight as possible. And you know, Tej, to this day, I don't know any athlete that has asked for heavier, you know, product that is less breathable, less lightweight, right? Less comfortable. So I think all of those requirements are function.
So Karen, like for common people, when they choose a footwear or a like apparel. So how do you make sure the brand message reaches to those audience as well when compared to athletes or celebrities?
Again, you're gonna probably get tired of me saying this, but you know, it's about listening to the consumer, right? Listening to the voice of the consumer and meeting them where they are. I think a great moment and a wonderful example that helps me think about is at the time when in sport footwear, again, in athletic apparel and footwear, where lifestyle met performance, right? It was the moment where, you know, people were wearing sneakers on the street as much as they were on the field of play. And, you know, that was no crystal ball looking of any of the brands, right? That was the consumer saying, you've given me this incredible product that works for athletes. I want that level of comfort and performance on my feet, on my body every day. And so I think that the whole lifestyle where that has merged was completely driven by, you know, what you would refer to as the non-athlete or the non-performance athlete. It's the desire for comfort. It's the desire to look great. It's the desire to have color materials that speak to my personality that has driven that moment.
Thank you, Karen. So can you talk about any particularly challenging project that you have worked on and how you overcame any obstacles during that project?
One of the challenges of that was very tied into what I was just describing to you about the moment where lifestyle and performance sort of met on the street, right, with the consumer. And I would say that was a moment at Reebok. So when I became creative director and leading innovation for the Reebok brand, they were presenting themselves to the consumer under two separate brands. They had the Reebok Delta brand, which was focused on performance, and they had the Reebok, the traditional more vector brand that was focused on lifestyle. And so they were going to market as two separate brands. And I think really understanding, again, what our consumer was telling us is that they don't differentiate and they don't wear product just based on whether it's performance or lifestyle. That really was a challenging moment for me as a creative director, is that, you know, I felt, and many of my colleagues felt, that we needed to go to market under one brand name. And, you know, those decisions are big decisions for a brand, right? Retail was branded in one way. Some product was branded in another way. So it would be an extreme effort to do that. And I do think that at the highest level of the brand, that recommendation come under one brand logo and logo was probably not the most popular decision. And that was a moment where I had to really say that I was hired to understand what was the best for the brand, what meant the best for the brand. And we made the decision, and I had a lot of support to go under the one brand name and one brand logo, I should be more specific. And, you know, that included taking signs down off of very large buildings and changing everything about the brand. But ultimately, we listened to what the consumer was telling us. They did not see a difference. And I believe the Reebok brand is more recognizable and probably more successful than they would have been if they had continued under two separate brands that the consumer was having a difficult time understanding, finding, and wanting to wear.
That's wonderful, Karen. So often in footwear and brand like apparels, people usually form communities. For example, let's take the example of Nike Air Jordans. So there's a community around that's been created with sneakerheads being, and it's been a continually evolving trend. So how do you think these communities drive brand decisions?
Well, I can only say that if a brand is true to their community and understand the hearts and minds of that community, they will influence product and influence the brand. I believe in the power of observation and connectivity, and designers, that is again one of our secret weapons. if you stay connected to that community, they will lead you to where you should be going as a brand. And this doesn't mean asking people what they want. This means about observing them in their everyday life. And, you know, as product designers, as product developers, we have to hedge those bets. We have to understand that and be there at least 18 months, if not 2 years ahead of them. So the power of observation is really, really critical.
Thank you so much, Karen. So how do you measure success in your designs, both creatively and commercially? And how do you approach collaboration with other designers or brands in the industry?
Well, ultimately, it's the consumer decides, right? If the consumer, if your product, if your experience, if your interface is resonating, it will result in success. I think, you know, profit is one way to measure success. I do think there are other ways to measure success as well. So diversity in the teams, inclusivity in the audience, really making sure that the product is respectful of people and the planet and that you're making the right decisions. I think there's a lot of different ways that I would measure success. You know, Tej, I mentioned I haven't been in the product creation world for the last couple of years. I've been in academia and loving every minute of it. But I would still say, you know, measuring the response, measuring the love, and, you know, seeing your product out in the market as someone who designs physical product is the most rewarding and I think the most telling.
Thank you so much, Karen. So wanted to take your thoughts on like, how is the fast fashion evolving like, and with every day some new designs or patterns being coming from different brands. So how is the decisions are being made as a creative direction perspective?
Well, as I mentioned, I'm not active in the industry today, and definitely not as active as I was before. But I have spent some time thinking about the area of fast fashion. And I would say that, you know, I'm really concerned about our trend towards overconsumption and the amount of product that we buy. And so I believe that even in the fast fashion industry, which I think creates an opportunity for people to buy into the dream of fashion at a price point that is more accessible, to be sure, I think we all have to look at our purchasing habits, and also how we can start to, you know, look at quality in a little bit of a different way as it relates to more longevity. So I do have a challenge overall with the industry. I think there is a lot of waste, but I also think there is, you know, a lot of innovation happening in the area of sustainability, textiles, making better product, and, you know, also just getting smarter about the way we design. But again, I think the amount of fashion that is bought and wasted is a challenge that we all have to face. And I think that, you know, fast fashion has a responsibility to that, as do many brands.
Thank you, Karen. So what's your thoughts on the emerging design trends or emerging way how fashion or apparel design will change with the rise of AI and evolving technologies?
I've been thinking a bit about that. And, you know, I see it as a blessing and a curse both. I think that, you know, AI will be another tool for designers to use. So I'm not ready to say that, you know, we should not look at it or not consider it. I think that, you know, most designers, we tend to not want to copy. We want to be more original and do and create products, places, experiences that are new and better. I think if AI can help us be more inclusive, if AI can help us understand our own brands better, so legacy of brands, being able to capture that, being able to do better research, perhaps, without having to travel quite as much. There's an opportunity there, perhaps. Although I don't think anything replaces travel. I think our ability to have boots on the ground and be inspired from all the places in the world that we need to be inspired by today, not the obvious choices of the past, is important. AI can help us there. But I do believe that originality approach is going to still be in the hands of the designer and how they choose to use the tools.
Thank you so much, Karen, for all these wonderful insights. So could you please share with us what are you currently doing after 20 plus years in sportswear and apparel industry, and any interesting stories that you would want to share with us?
Yes, thank you. So I was part of the Harvard Advanced Leadership Initiative program, which was a two-year fellowship for me. And it really is connected to, they call it third chapter, which could mean maybe ready to retire from one part of a business or one part of a career into what's next and how, you know, you want to make the world a better place, right? So it's focused on social impact and the difference that you can bring as an individual with your background and your personal agency. So after spending time in my fellowship, I really began to focus on gender bias in design and how we are still designing products that are primarily designed by men for men. And I'd like to say that these products can range from, you know, insulting, what we often refer to as shrink it and pink it, to deadly. The case of in the US, we are not testing with female crash test dummies in the driver's seat for safety, resulting in 73% more women being injured as a result, car accidents. And so I started to dig into that a little bit, Tejan, and had a few statistics that I found really disturbing, especially after having spent a career in design. Only 18% of practicing industrial designers in the US today are women. In the UK, it's 5%, with only 11% in leadership. The number is similar for architects, and in mechanical engineering, it's less than 13%. So I believe without having our female designers' voices at the table, we're going to continue to have, you know, places where we are not being inclusive in our design. So it's gender diversity in design and also design for gender diversity. And this is really the opportunity that Harvard afforded me, was really to have that focus and to speak with the voice of someone who has been in the business and in the industry for a long time. I'm very much committed to building a more inclusive, hospitable, and safe world for her.
Thank you so much, Karen, for sharing all these wonderful insights. We'll conclude today's episode by your three favorite books and people who inspire you the most in the space.
Oh, if you know me, I read a lot. So getting it down to three was not easy. So if there was a place where I can share more, I would be happy to do that. So I would say first and foremost, a book called Power for All by Julie Badalana has been very influential for me in the way I'm looking at the world today. Reimagining Capitalism from Rebecca Henderson. I do believe there's a role for capitalism, an important role, but I think we have to look at redesigning capitalism. And then there's a book by author Charlotte Alter, and it's called The Ones We've Been Waiting For. And it really is about the next generation, right? The Gen Z primarily, and what they will bring and how they will be the ones that will be able to solve for much of the challenges we face today. So those are my three books. People, even harder than books. So John Hoke, who is the chief design officer at Nike today, and has been a friend, a former colleague, and a former boss, has been incredibly inspirational to me and influential, and continues to be today. Hannah Riley Bowles, who is the director of the Center for Public Leadership at the Kennedy School and the head of the Women in Public Policy program at Harvard, has been an incredible inspiration for me, especially as I've made this pivot. And someone I don't know, who I would love to meet someday, is Mika Brzezinski and her initiative around Know Your Value and the work she's doing together with Forbes.
Thank you so much, Karen, for sharing all these wonderful recommendations. So we're looking forward to hosting you again in our upcoming episodes. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Tej.